The concept of urban agriculture has grown in popularity and innovation over the past few years. Joe Nasser, a professor at the Center for Studies in Food Security at Ryerson University in Toronto and co-author of Carrot City, Creating Places for Urban Agriculture, joins us now to talk about the growing trend of farming in the cities. Also with us are Eli Zabar, who maintains greenhouses on the roof of his Upper East Side marketplace, The Vinegar Factory, and Annie Novak, co-founder of the Eagle Street Rooftop Farm in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. It's great to have you all on the show again. And welcome back, to Eli and Annie.
Thank you.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you. Joe, can you define urban agriculture for us?
Well, I tend to define it in the broadest sense of any food production and sometimes other things as well that come either directly inside the city or even in the very close by vicinity.
Well, in some cultures, food has always been grown within the city. But are we seeing something else happening? Is there a global trend here where farmers are coming back to the cities?
Well, anyway, it never left, even in the U.S., but it maybe went a bit under the radar. Some people still continue to grow in their backyards and their balconies some herbs and tomatoes and so on. But it is definitely a revival from, you know, I've been around it for a couple of decades, and it's a very different situation in recognition compared to back then.
Well, you're talking about something a little more ambitious than growing something on the fire escape. Did you visit the places that you write about in this book?
I always try to visit as many of them as possible. It's always important to have a first-hand look. But to be clear, some of them are also more conceptual, just to show what is possible. So not everything in the book exists, but we try to include as many real cases as possible.
Like vertical farming.
Vertical farming, as in multi-story vertical farming, is still mostly on the drawing book, though the farms on that are above the ground, such as Eagle Street, and more of them do exist today.
Although I've wondered about vertical farming for a long time, we did a show about it maybe 10 years ago, and it sounded like the first vertical farm would be created any minute after that, and here we are 10 years later, and it's still just some kind of a fantasy. What's the problem?
Some of it is cost, and some of it is the specific techniques and getting it right, and some of it is maybe getting the confidence. It's always a challenge with a new thing. No one wants to be first, especially when it's a business, an enterprise. No one wants to take a chance, necessarily.
You've included Annie's Eagle Street Rooftop Farm and Eli's Vinegar Factory Greenhouse. And they're both in the city, and I can't imagine two projects that could be more different, even though they both take place on rooftops.
Right, and others are also as different for us, such as ones that are more hydroponic, as well as school gardens that are more and more on rooftops. So we had plenty of choices of cases from New York City. We had to actually almost tone it down a little. We could have had more cases.
I'm glad you brought up the schools. We keep on getting announcements from various schools that they're getting seriously into farming, and that's something that I couldn't have imagined when I was going to school here in New York. Eli, were you something of a pioneer when you started growing produce on the Vinegar Factory's roof in 1995?
Oh, I think so. But, I never really paid attention to what was going on in the outside world.
In New York, or did you hear about people doing something similar in other parts of the country or other parts of the world?
No. It's hard to recreate the memory going back that far, but what I had was heat, because I had a bakery, a pastry shop on the second floor of a building that I owned. And on the ground floor was the retail supermarket, the Vinegar Factory, and so we had a lot of heat. And I thought, I wanted to grow tomatoes. That was my goal.
And the heat was just escaping.
Exactly. Yeah, it was going into the atmosphere. And I thought, well, okay, why don't we just capture it in a greenhouse? Just send it, you know, passively. Heat rises. It's a two-story building. What seemed like a very simple, easy project, just buy a hoop greenhouse and let the warm air passively warm it and try to grow tomatoes. I spent a couple of years of failure at that. It's much more complicated. Tomatoes, especially, are much more sensitive to they're very sensitive to temperature and light factors. But we did discover out of it because it was a hoop type greenhouse, which it came to the shape doesn't allow you to grow tall on at each side. So we planted beds of lettuces, and those just thrived. So that was a good beginning.
These are the same kinds of hoop greenhouses that we see on some farms, sometimes mobile greenhouses. They move them around. But in your case, you're just putting boxes with soil in them?
Well, what we did is that we built beds. We started with one greenhouse, and it was so promising that I ended up reinforcing the building, and I became very ambitious and so on and so forth.
Because this could be very heavy. There's a lot. Soil weighs a lot.
Soil weighs a lot.
And you grow tomatoes 12 months a year?
No. That was the idea, and we tried that for a while, but there really isn't enough light, and then I used artificial light. We had sodium 500-watt bulbs, and it was so expensive to do, and the neighbors, it lit the place up like Yankee Stadium, and we had so many complaints, and we had blackout curtains, and the yield was so small. That I abandoned, and we only grow what are called heirloom variety tomatoes, indeterminate varieties, and they're even more sensitive than there are hybrids that have been developed for greenhouse that can grow 12 months of the year possibly, but they don't taste like anything.
Now, Annie, you started Eagle Street Rooftop Farm in 2009, but not with a greenhouse.
No, first and foremost, the Eagle Street Rooftop Farm is a green roof, and that was important to the building on our Broadway stages for their own benefits and to Good Green, the company that did the installation.
Were they producing a lot of heat as well?
The building below, yeah. You mean? Oh, it's interesting, actually. When we first started the project, the building, I think one of the reasons the building was a candidate among all of Broadway Stages' studios for this development is that it was not really being used. And so they went ahead and did the construction of the green roof. And the rest of the building is sort of caught up. So now we're at a point where there's this huge production going on below, and they're using thousands of kilowatts of power. And this would, if anything, this would be the year to figure out what exactly we're doing as a green roof.
And what do you mean by a green roof? You had to lay down some special surface on the roof before you could put soil down?
Good Green did pretty traditional green roof installation. They put down a root barrier, which, of course, is the best. That's a protective layer for the roof. And then on top of that, the green roof layers, which to the farmer's understanding are what we make use of to capture water. And it acts as a reservoir system for our plants' roots. The soil is really shallow. It's about 7 inches of growing media. One of the reasons I've steered clear of doing things like adding additional structures like a greenhouse or even simple hoop system is we actually were just talking about this a little bit, Eli and I, because the period of rest that comes in the winter and the not making an effort to extend the growing season too much longer is vital for me. We, as a green roof, we lose a lot of nutrients. There's a good amount of runoff in our soil. And I like the idea that I have this period where the daylight hours are shorter, there's a cover crop in, and I'm sort of gearing up for a richer spring. I am a little jealous because Eli has the captured heat and that he can start his tomatoes in February. That additional month for me, I'm putting in salad greens and snap peas and cold hardy vegetables. In the meantime, I'm following pretty much a traditional growing season.
So you're doing the same sort of thing that a farm in the Hudson Valley or New Jersey might do, except that you're working with much shallower soil deposits, aren't you? And you said you had to put something down to protect the roof against roots because the roots would bore into the roof and
sure,
and
you see this with trees breaking up sidewalks. I mean, plants are pretty powerful little guys. We also, I mean, one huge consideration, of course, is the Department of Buildings. And when we went ahead to do the green roof installation, we followed the permitting for what that would entail. We did not actually apply to do any additional structures. And I came up against that when we discovered that our chicken coop was actually considered an additional structure. We got a little bit of trouble for having chickens. So we're going to steer clear of hoops for now.
Did you have to do structural work the way that Eli did to strengthen the roof?
We were lucky in that Broadway Stages has this this property is a very beautiful old iron-beamed warehouse from the 1800s. And so we just sort of went, when Good Green did the design, they just went with the capacity of the roof. So 200,000 pounds of growing media was determined to be the weight the building could hold.
And Eli talked about learning along the way, things that he thought might do well, turned out not to do well. Have you gone through a similar learning curve?
Yeah, all of the knowledge I had in farming was ground level growing and working here in the Hudson Valley. And there are some small differences, like the fact that the city is about 3 degrees warmer any time of the year than it is upstate.
Is that good?
I would not say in an overall sense it's good, but in an agricultural purveyor sense, it's wonderful. The other really interesting thing for me was working with a different type of soil. I mean, soil is an enormously complex and delicious thing. And the growing media that we use is... it's unique and it's different from what I've used before.
My guests are Annie Novak of Eagle Street Rooftop Farm and also Growing Chefs. We'll get into that later. Eli Zabar, who has a number of different outlets, Zabar's Eat and the Vinegar Factory. And Joe Nasser, who is co-author of Carrot City, a new book about urban farming, published by Monticelli Press with lots of wonderful pictures in it and enough to inspire anybody who has a strong roof to consider growing on it. We'll be back right after this. We're back with Joe Nasser, N-A-S-R, co-author, or I guess, do we call it a co-author when there were three authors?
Yeah.
Also with Mark Gorgolevsky and Julie Karmisar of a book called Carrot City, Creating Places for Urban Agriculture, published by Monticelli Press, and just gorgeous color photographs throughout, showing us what can be done in various places. And we're talking about rooftop gardens of the sort we're discussing here, but also community gardens, school gardens. What else, Joe?
Well, yeah, I mean, we, on purpose, we wanted to show just the great variety of possibilities and ideas. Part of the kind of, we had so many cases to select from, and part of it was to try to show that individual, in some cases, like one case in Brooklyn, an individual growing on their rooftop to a school garden, to more futuristic, provocative things that some people said, do you really agree with this proposal or that proposal? And we thought it's more important to provoke a good discussion about the future of growing food and what it means to do it this way and that way than to editorialize it and leave out things.
Now, listeners have been writing in. One who lives in Brooklyn says he had his soil tested and was told it wasn't good. How can he deal with that? Does he just have to build boxes and buy soil?
It's a really good idea to get your soil tested. And the first thing you're looking for, of course, is lead, because that means that not only can you not grow food crops, but you should be careful handling it, like even if you want to do sunflowers, because it's no good to have that under your fingernails. I think the route that most people would take is raised beds, and you can bring in soil, you can purchase it, and there are a number of resources for that. But it is important, and you can do any of those tests through the extension offices, including Brooklyn College now.
But even if you get good soil, another listener asks, how concerned should we be about the purity of food raised in areas where there is a lot of air pollution?
Oh, I love this question.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing with air pollution depends there's many things in the air, and some things like lead actually don't travel far at all. So this is very much a more localized issues that can be looked for, whereas a lot of the air pollutants travel well into the rural areas, and so the very greater New York and beyond would be affected as well. So it's a question of what one feels comfortable with and how much you're willing to invest into checking things, and how that balances out access to fresh nutrition, better quality stuff, because ultimately it's a trade-off.
And well, Joe also mentions in Carrot City studies in the United Kingdom where it talks about the amount of air pollution that comes as a result of food production. And so when you're talking about local food as you're worrying about air pollution, I worry about non-local food being a cause of air pollution.
Because it's being trucked in.
For many trucks, yeah. Ships, and, planes.
And because all kinds of things go into its production to begin with.
Now, a listener also wonders about rodents, rats and squirrels and stuff. How do you protect your food from that?
Well, mostly I'm in greenhouses, but outdoors, we do grow outdoors starting in the late spring. We'll propagate in the greenhouse and put it outside. And you were just saying during the intermission about you had the squirrels that ate your tomatoes. This is your right.
Well, they don't like the cherry tomatoes, but they like the big ones.
Well, we can't grow melons. They get to the point where they're ripe, and then the squirrels come from. There are big high rises next to me, and I'm on two sides of the street. I have about a half an acre. So I have about 20,000 square feet.
Well, I've come to hate squirrels at the same time. I've respected them as a lot more intelligent than I thought they were. They're really clever. Was it difficult to get your roofs approved for agriculture by the New York City government?
Well, I don't know that we ever really did. I work with a great architect named Richard Lewis, and who's very much into food in every possible way and has done lots of restaurants. Not that that has to do with growing food, but he himself lives up in Westchester and enjoys growing his gardens. And, they were filed as structures that we were permitted to build. We didn't tell them. The building department doesn't ask you what you're going to do in the structure. They just want to make sure the structure is legal, and they are legal.
Well, I have talked about these issues with Scott Stringer, the Manhattan Borough President, and also with Christine Quinn, the Speaker of the City Council, and they seem to be encouraging people to do urban farming. Have you had any support from the city government, Danny?
One of the greatest pieces of legislation that's happened in the past couple of years is with the advocacy of people like Scott Stringer and the organization Just Food, we were able to re-legalize beekeeping. And to me, you know, this is one of the neat sort of sub-genres of urban agriculture, but we were just talking, we were making fun of how squirrels are such a pain in the neck. I think that perception of nature inserting itself into life in the city always sort of causes people alarm, but honeybees and squirrels and pigeons and rats and all of this is, it's an ecosystem, guys. Like, I know there are a lot of buildings, but...
Let me jump in here and tell you just a cute story, because all of our tomatoes are propagated by bees, and they're up in the greenhouse in boxes, but the bees like to escape, and occasionally they'll escape into the supermarket below. and we've had a couple of issues where they've kind of flown around and bit somebody, or they didn't really bite.
They just like to be there.
But they were frightened. They frightened some of the clientele.
At the Green Market in Union Square, there's a honey cellar, and there are always bees flying around the jars of honey, and that's part of the fun. Now, Joe, have cities been encouraging this development?
This is across North America. What you see these days is kind of a transition where you have both some resistance, some hesitation by some places, while many others, even within the same city, some planners working with the groups to facilitate, or some other planners or some code enforcement officers cracking down. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because often that brings about a topic into public discussion, and then it ends up resulting in a change that facilitates it for everyone else.
Well, you're in Toronto, where winters are a lot colder than they are here. So how much rooftop gardening can take place in Toronto?
I must say, on the rooftop front, New York is ahead of Toronto. There are some wonderful examples there, and including one amazing one on top of the probably like kind of the grand old hotel of the city, the Royal York, which is facing the main train station. And you have all the chefs in the kitchen taking part as part of their apprenticeship on the roof there. So that is one outstanding roof. But there are also great greenhouse examples and cultivation in the field. I mean, everyone is learning these days.
Well, both you, Annie, and you, Eli, have private gardens here. But when Rudolph Giuliani was the mayor, he was intent on closing down a lot of community gardens because he saw that land as being valuable for other kinds of uses. Was that something that concerned you at the time?
I don't remember it, actually. I don't. But
and,
no,
and you were probably in Chicago at that time. Anne.
I was in Chicago, but I'm post facto furious. Yes.
Well, but there's no question that the present administration is extremely pro everything that's good for the city, and Amanda Burden and the parks and so everything is developing well here now.
Well, it's a good use of a vacant lot, isn't it? And Joe, you have a lot of farms all over the world that started as vacant lots.
Right. Actually, that's probably maybe one of the most common cases of that we feature. I mean, you have the rooftops, you have some yards and so on, but certainly a number of cases are found on unused spaces, whether it's vacant lots or sometimes around buildings and so on. But this also brings up, this is why, I mean, this whole initiative started by focusing on how to design for these spaces. This is where the design come in. You just don't grow on a vacant lot or on a asphalt surface or on a concrete former schoolyard in the same way as you would just in your yard you dig in. So it's that involves all kinds of adaptation and design thinking.
Well, how cost effective is all of this? It occurred to me that when I added up the cost of soil and nutrients and all the other things that I had done to grow tomatoes, that my tomatoes were costing me $2 or $3 a piece, maybe more. Can this be done, for example, in your case, Eli, in a way where you can make a profit selling it in the market, or do you have to charge an exorbitant amount of money?
Well, we do get a lot of money for the tomatoes, but basically, you know, after the initial investment, we have two full time people, and we're gardening a half an acre. We with the lettuces, and we only let those lettuces grow for 2 weeks, and then we cut them, so they're baby and they're very intensely. Mm-hmm. Flavored. We never really did a study economically, but I'm certain, you know, I'm certain that there is a benefit here.
This won't be an original thought, but the other point that you're raising is when you talk about an expensive tomato, is that food costs a lot of money. I mean, the fact that food is cheap is an illusion in a lot of ways. And I think the first time I started working for a full organic farmer and went through a full growing season, I watched her economic ups and downs. I mean, the woman doesn't pay herself. Like, she's growing some of the most beautiful food. It's priced at Union Square prices, and she's not making an income, because at the end of the day, it's expensive to be a good farmer, and it's certainly labor intensive. So the $2 or the $6 tomato story is always interesting to me, because, you know, of course it's expensive to do this. We're valuable, intelligent people, and we cost a lot of money to do things.
You also co-founded an organization called Growing Chefs. Can you tell us about that?
Growing Chefs, I started in 2005. I had just graduated college, and I was sort of looking out into the world for the job I wanted. I didn't quite see it. And it's a nonprofit that's dedicated to teaching food from field to fork. We have a number of schoolyard garden programs, and we do work in the classroom and in the garden. It's been the great joy of my life, because endless mysteries and stories evolve from that.
And Joe, this is something we've been seeing all over the world now, kids getting encouraged to think about farming. They're not becoming farmers, are they?
Well, actually, interesting. One of the more outstanding cases in Toronto is, there's a general campaign for a garden in every school of some form, ultimately, but within that, those are more kind of limited educational pieces. But there is one case where it is more of a market garden, where the skills that high school youth who are taking part in it is to prepare to know how to deal with soil and compost, as well as marketing, and this is just in the last year or two, but it's been quite successful, and the hope is for this to be the basis for a variety of skills. So it goes beyond becoming a formal urban farmer.
One of the things I just wanted to mention, I run something called I'm a partner with the Peconic Land Trust, and I run something called the Amagansett Farmers Market. And one of the things that I did was network about 20 or 25 farmers, or mostly organic farmers, and we pick up at their farms. Most of these farmers are too small to be in farmers markets or travel long. long way. So we've solved that. But the Peconic Land Trust behind my market had 7 acres that are farmed by two ladies, and they call themselves the Amber Wave Farm. And they have done a magnificent initiative in education, bringing into all the local schools, teaching kids about farming. And I can't say enough good things about what they have done.
Joe, now, Carrot City first started as an exhibition. Was anything added in the transition from exhibit to book?
Oh, it's still underway. This project has taken a life we never expected. It's still traveling. It's going to be in France next year and England probably. The way it's evolved is all the new cases that are associated. We always try to come up with new cases. When it went into the book, we did that, and then we're continuing to do that, and we updated, included in the website we created, carrotcity.org. So we have now upward of 70 cases on the website, and we hope to hit 100 soon.
Well, you address the issue of the obesity epidemic in your introduction, and I'm sure that that's a concern of everybody in this field right now. Do you think that this growing interest is in response to that, or is it just are there larger issues involved?
Sure. Everyone that we come across, particularly at Rooftop Farm, and they come and work with us, there are so many factors as to why people want to get back into handling the soil. And I definitely, and you see this with, and you mentioned Carrot City as well, Joe, the White House garden, and what a difference that made for our country when Michelle Obama started gardening. And for her, of course, with the Let's Move campaign, that was a big part of it.
And we thank the three of you so much for coming by to talk about all of this. Andy Novak of Eagle Street Rooftop Farm and Growing Chefs, Eli Zabar. And Eli, I've left out a few things. Zabar's Eat, the Vinegar Factory. What else?
Grand Central's, Eli Zabar, Grand Central Station. Eli's Essentials next to the Whitney Museum.
And Joe Nasser, one of the authors of Carrot City from Monticelli Press. Thank you all.
Thank you.